Welcome to the Blockchain Practitioners Podcast, where we interview founders, leaders, professors, and experts in the blockchain industry about the projects they are working on. On this podcast, we try to learn something new about an industry which will, in a few years, affect the lives of us all. My name is Steven, and I'm your host for this episode. My next guest has been a blockhead since 2015, is a mathematician, and holds a PhD in number theory from Indiana University. He spent his late 20s in Japan to build algorithms to diagnose diseases and disorders. After he moved to Silicon Valley, he worked at Google on TensorFlow and built knowledge graphs that are still being used by major US healthcare organizations today. He went his own way after being head of AI and blockchain at Doc.ai to become the current CEO of Moonstream.to. So, welcome, Neeraj Kashyap. Can you please introduce yourself?
Hi, nice to meet you, Stephen. My name is Neeraj. I'm the founder of a company called Moonstream. I'm also a mathematician and a games player. I play a lot of games, you know, all the time. Nice. Moonstream, you know, what we're building right now is we're quite involved in the blockchain and in Web3. And we play games and we build games on the Ethereum blockchain and other like Ethereum-based blockchains as well. We really believe in the power of like decentralized content creation and sort of collaborative creation, the kind of collaborative creation that the blockchain makes possible. We're very excited about the space, and I guess that's what we're going to be talking about today, right?
I'm actually excited to dive into this one. But before we go into Moonstream, you have quite the journey. So you had quite a journey to arrive at Moonstream, which is now your latest project. But could you tell us a little bit of how you got here today?
Yeah, sure. As I said, I'm a mathematician. And when I say that I'm a mathematician, I mean, I'm the kind of mathematician. I started my life as a kind of person who was just doing all of their work on, you know, with pencil and a piece of paper. I was doing mathematical research for a large part of like, you know, my late teens and my early 20s. I was doing research specifically in number theory. So I was sort of like very deeply entrenched and involved and like cared about academia for a very long time. And what sort of brought me out of that was around the time that I was finishing up my PhD, my grandmother got very ill. And she had a disease called progressive supranuclear palsy. It's a neurodegenerative disease, so it breaks down like your neurological system. And it's similar to diseases like Parkinson's disease, or other palsies. And for a long time, the doctors thought that she had Parkinson's disease. So for several years, she was actually being medicated for Parkinson's disease rather than the disease that she actually had. My mother was taking care of her, and it was just a very rough situation. I realized that I would much rather be doing work that had a direct impact on people like my grandmother or like, you know, people who like actually had problems in the real world than doing mathematical research that like, you know, only a handful of people cared about, and which I was caring less and less about sort of as time went on. And so that was sort of how I got out of academia and into technology. So after I finished my PhD, I moved to Japan, where a friend of mine was doing, you know, research in a similar direction as I was interested in around like these diseases. And so while I was in Japan, I lived there for 2 years. My friend and I, we developed an algorithm along with a few other people to diagnose these kinds of neurodegenerative disorders using a very simple equipment. So we had a Nintendo Wii balance board and Nintendo Wii controllers that, you know, we would put on different parts of a person and make them do like various movements. And then our algorithm would sort of classify, you know, what kind of movements they had and if those movements were symptomatic of like certain of different neurodegenerative diseases. So that research is actually still in clinical trials in Japan. But after a couple of years there, you know, living as a foreigner in Japan, I realized like it was going to be pretty hard for me to like, you know, make a like, you know, spend the rest of my life there. And so then I moved to the Bay Area and I got into technology based on the work that I was doing over there. So since I've been here, I've worked at companies large and small. Like I used to work on the TensorFlow team at Google. I quickly realized that big companies were not for me. So then I've you know, mostly just been working in startups until I founded Moonstream, and now you know we're sort of going it by ourselves. So yeah.
So you did work in the healthcare sector before you went to Moonstream.
Yeah.
And in our pre-interview, you told me there was a specific kind of problem that kind of became a passion for you, which was a passion for digital representation of knowledge.
Yeah.
Is that what led you to blockchain technology?
Actually, it is. It sort of accidentally led me to blockchain technology. So one of the biggest problems in artificial intelligence, in my opinion, I mean, a lot of people who are like, you know, practicing it or like, you know, professionals in it may disagree with me. But I think like one of the most critical and foundational problems in artificial intelligence is being able to is developing digital representations of knowledge. The only reason that we have, well, one of the main reasons that we have machine learning models that are as powerful as they are today is because of the work that people did creating data sets that that the machine learning models could be trained on. There are like a couple of really noteworthy initiatives around the creation of data sets. I think the two that I would mention, like, you know, any day that they're sort of universally like important to everyone are there's WordNet, which is basically like a corpus of words with relationships between words represented in the knowledge base as well. And then there's ImageNet, which is a body of images with like classification describing what the content of those images is, right? And the ImageNet specifically has been very important in the development of modern machine learning, because the ImageNet dataset, which is a very high quality dataset, basically the machine learning community or the creators of ImageNet, they created a competition around it to, you know, as a challenge, like how well can machine learning researchers do in classifying images in ImageNet, you know, as accurately as possible, you know, given the labels that the human labelers sort of like, you know, assign to those images. And the modern deep learning, the way that we know it, it started off with this neural network called AlexNet, which just like, you know, blew all the previous benchmarks out of the water. And so, you know, without the ImageNet challenge in the first place, there wouldn't even have been like this objective criterion or like, you know, this target that people had in order to like, you know, when they were trying to build architectures or machine learning models that could perform well at human-like tasks. And so knowledge representation, digital knowledge representation, I think is a very important problem. It's not a very glamorous problem to solve, so it doesn't get a lot of like, you know, attention or, you know, like care from the community, but I think it's a very important problem to solve. And it's also a very difficult problem to solve. Like, this is something that we discovered while we were doing our medical research. You know, how do you establish your ground truths about, like, you know, we were getting all of this data from the Nintendo Wii balance boards and the accelerometers and the gyroscopes about how people were moving. But establishing that ground truth about, like, you know, these are the movement patterns of a person who does not have a disorder. These are the movement patterns of a person who has Parkinson's disease. These are the movement patterns of a person who has dementia. These are the movement patterns of someone who has like cerebral palsy. Like, those things are really hard. Those baselines are very hard to establish. And that's actually the reason that most of these diseases are diagnosed very late by doctors, because doctors don't want to make errors in the diagnosis. And in the interests of being safe, they can only diagnose the diseases once they're at a quite advanced stage of development, right? So even defining what those baselines are, defining like, you know, what the dynamics are that determine whether someone has a condition or not, that's very difficult to do. And it's made even more difficult by the fact that there's no like body of knowledge that you can refer to or that you can run analysis against in order to make those determinations. And so that's what got me interested in the problem of finding digital representations of knowledge. Like, you know, one of the problems that my collaborators and I used to talk about was just building a dictionary of human movements that you could like, you know, sort of look stuff up against, like, okay, this is a dance, or this is someone like a child playing with a cat, or this is like a someone walking up the stairs. Having like that sort of a reference dictionary of movements would be an extremely powerful thing, and that's a really strong idea, and it's a very difficult thing to sort of implement. And that's sort of what got me interested in that problem. But ever since then, I found that not having digital representations of knowledge is like an obstacle to like almost everything that we do, and people don't realize it. So I started Moonstream with this idea of like, you know, building a tool that would make it easy to, you know, create digital representations of various types of knowledge. And the way that we ended up on the blockchain, I mean, I've been interested in the blockchain since for a long time, for many years now, and I've been involved in even building on the blockchain since 2016. But with Moonstream, the way we ended up here was that, you know, with transactions that happen on a blockchain, like on Ethereum or on Bitcoin or, you know, the kinds of major blockchains, everything that happens there is public information. So here you have a wealth of data, right? Of like, you know, people making like, you know, on Ethereum, you're seeing about 200 transactions every 15 seconds, right? So you're seeing 800 transactions per minute. So you're seeing like hundreds of thousands of transactions per hour, right? And you're seeing like millions of transactions per day. And this has been happening since what, like late 2015, early 2016. So you have like this wealth of data available to you. And you also have like some information about semantics from like, you know, external prices or, you know, things like that. So it's really a good target to build an ontology, to build like this sort of digital representation of knowledge, because the base, you know, the base data is already digital. So it's something that's easy to consume. And that's sort of like how we got involved with the blockchain. And then since then, you know, we started off just by building analytics, you know, using the representations that we were creating to make an analytics tool for people who were running their projects on Web3 to understand who their users were, how they were using their products, and so on. And very quickly after that, the people who were using Moonstream, they came to us and they said, like, this is great. Now we understand, like, you know, how people are using our products, but we'd also like to sort of have a feedback mechanism. So if we see, you know, for example, for games, if we see that there's too much inflation in our economy, or if someone is hoarding wealth or something like that, we'd like to introduce mechanics back onto the blockchain, which incentivize those people to behave in ways that are more healthy for our economy. And then so from there, we actually grew. Like, not only do we have digital representations of knowledge, but now we have algorithms which take those digital representations of knowledge and automatically use them to produce these on-chain mechanisms that allow people to control their economies. And that's sort of how we've grown.
Wow, that's a a complicated technology that is really necessary.
Yeah. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
I'm listening. I'm super interested. So that's why. I just want to go back one step and ask you, like, do you remember the first time you actually interacted with blockchain, or when you kind of got that enlightenment, or how do we say it, like the aha blockchain moment?
Actually, that's a good question. I don't think I ever had an aha. I had a series of aha moments for different like pieces of blockchain technology. I don't think I ever had an aha blockchain moment. The first time I ever interacted with anything on the blockchain was I used to be like a pretty active Reddit user. And for a long time, Reddit, this is in the early days even of Reddit, right? So people would use Dogecoin as tips on Reddit. So if you like made a post, like as a joke, people would give you Dogecoin, never imagining what would happen to Dogecoin in 2020, 2021, right? Those were my first interactions with the blockchain, and I thought it was cool. But at that point, I never understood, like, you know, what were the key differences between like a blockchain, like a cryptocurrency like Dogecoin, and just points on like a Reddit database somewhere, right? I never really understood those differences. I became much more interested in, I would say, 2013, 2014, when I started reading like some of the white papers, Bitcoin, and so on. And, you know, I started like purchasing cryptocurrency at that time. And then when Ethereum was released, so Ethereum was very exciting to me when it was released, because it was no longer just, you know, something that was relegated to the realm of a currency. I mean, there is logic on Bitcoin. There are like some simple scripts that you can run in Bitcoin, but Ethereum was explicitly created as a global computer, right? As a world computer. And for me, that vision was very exciting. And so I quickly just, you know, went all in on the Ethereum ecosystem. And then I think in Web3 gaming, for a long time, I wasn't like very interested in NFTs. Last year, I became quite interested in NFTs. I still think most NFT projects are not worth anyone's time. But with
Which is
games,
true.
it's true, and it's proving itself to be true right now.
Yeah.
But with games, last year there was a project that really opened my eyes to the potential of what's possible, what kind of things NFTs make possible for people who really like spend the time creating experiences around them, and that was the Loot project on Ethereum. And basically, what these guys did was they created a bunch of NFTs, which were very simple in nature. So each Loot project NFT is 6 lines of text, and each line is like the kind of equipment that you would see on a character in like a fantasy video game, right? Like a standard medieval fantasy role-playing game. What kind of, like, there'll be some armor, there'll be a weapon, there'll be like boots, there'll be, you know, this kind of stuff. So they just released the NFTs like that, and actually they did an airdrop of those NFTs, I believe. But the cool thing about what they did was they, you know, they built an audience for that kind of content around the theme of, like, you know, fantasy, like role-playing games, like, you know, just that kind of a universe. And on the other end, they created a community of creators. And the value proposition to the creators was like, you know, hey, create content for the Loot community. And you have like a large number of highly engaged people who are ready to consume your content, and you can directly monetize it. And, like, you know, you can actually like make a living creating content that you love. And on the other side, to the audience, they said, you know, we have a community of content creators who are creating content that, like, you know, that match your aesthetics and the themes that you care about. And all you need to do is have one of these NFTs in order to, like, you know, consume that content. And that the creation of like that kind of a, you know, decentralized community around like a single idea, they released the seed of an idea. They didn't, you know, release a game. They didn't release like a completed idea. And that's actually very important with crypto, is they released the seed of an idea and they allowed the community to take control of it and to define, like, you know, how they wanted that idea to evolve. And that really opened my eyes to the potential of this space of Web3 gaming. So that was very exciting for me. And we've been involved in Web3 gaming ever since. Yeah.
Yeah, I find that talking to people who are in blockchain, that they have a completely different ideology than you know, your run-of-the-mill CEO, or you know, it's always about people giving the freedom, preserving their privacy, their rights, and making sure that everybody just, you know, works together. It's such a difference, and it's such a nice breath of fresh air. To have people like CEOs of companies like you, for example, who are just like talking about letting the community decide and giving people tools to make things better instead of just, you know, looking at the monetization.
You know, I think what the big difference is between more traditional ways of thinking and like the kind of people who are building things in on the blockchain is, you know, like your traditional corporate people basically view their activities as they view themselves as being engaged in a zero-sum game. So for example, like if you're the CEO, let's say you're the CEO of like some large public company, you know, you need to prove to your shareholders that you're doing better than your competitors, or like, you know, basically all that matters is that you have to prove that you're doing better than like a set of other companies that people compare you to. And you know, by hook or by crook, if you can prove that, then there's like unlimited riches at your disposal, or like large riches at your disposal. And if you fail to do that, then, like, you know, there's just doom, like, you know, awaiting you. And so it's a very different mechanic. It's a very different like dynamic for people who are like, you know, running those kinds of companies, who are operating in that kind of an environment. I think the people, there's a lot of scams and a lot of Ponzi schemes and a lot of pyramid schemes, and there's a lot of stuff to be suspicious of. In crypto, there's like really a lot of fishy stuff going on, but there is a core group of people who are just genuinely building things for the sake of, you know, building a better future for, you know, for themselves, for everyone, to be honest. And I think the difference in mentality is that people in crypto understand that it's not a zero sum game, and that basically you can create value. So the reason that, for example, that a lot of crypto projects are happy to sort of share upside with their communities is because they understand that value, that it's much better to create new value than to compete over sort of existing value, because when you compete over existing value, you're participating in a zero-sum game. And over here, you have a positive-sum game where you actually, if you create new types of value to other people, then everybody benefits, really. And so, and you can take a share of that value that you're creating, and the other people can take a share of that value that you're creating. And by allowing everyone to take their fair share of the value that's being generated, not only does that value get generated sort of more permanently, but everyone also benefits. And you need other people to participate in order to benefit. Until cryptocurrencies existed, we'd only ever seen this kind of dynamic when we moved away from like gold-backed currencies or like, you know, to really fiat currencies. And that was, you know, only in the purview of governments, right? That was like happening at the scale of geopolitics. And now it's happening at the scale of like regular people like you and me. And so now this is like a revelation, I think, to society.
Yeah. And the technology is also so new that we're talking about early adopters.
Yeah.
And we're talking about visionaries. And that's also one of the reasons why doing these podcasts are so amazing, because we're talking to visionaries and people who try to do stuff that has never been done before.
Yeah.
So you kind of gave us the explanation of what Moonstream is. Mm-hmm. But for people who can't really envision that, I wanted to ask, how does working with Moonstream look? What does that look like? And maybe can you give an example?
Yeah, sure. So usually the people that work with Moonstream or the people who end up like using Moonstream are game designers or game developers who are releasing games on the blockchain. And most of these game designers, what they need is, you know, they're very good at like designing games or making games, but usually like the idea of like integrating their games with the blockchain is a little bit difficult to, you know, to really understand what that looks like. How they use Moonstream is Moonstream gives them, you know, our platform is quite battle tested. So this year alone, we've done over $3 billion in transaction volume across our platform. We have like top notch security. We're making it as easy as possible for people to use. They can just call they call our servers, and our servers sort of handle, for example, the distribution of tokens to their players. They can use our servers to create, do you play any games by the way yourself, Steven?
Not really, no.
Okay.
Not yet. I
have
to get into them, but no, not yet. I've tried Sandbox. That's the only one I've tried.
I don't mean blockchain games. I mean, do you play like any regular games? Like
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
Which games do you play?
I like, this is not sponsored. I like Vermintide 2. Uh-huh. A lot, okay. And Deep Rock Galactic are two of my favorite games right now.
Those are like both Warhammer 40K universe games, right? Is Vermintide like
The first one is a Warhammer game. The second one is an indie game from Coffee Stain Studios.
Okay, nice. I guess, is Vermintide similar to, is it like the Warhammer fantasy, like, I'm not so familiar with like the games in that universe, but you have like, it's a party-based, like a squad-based combat.
Yeah, you have four people, and it's basically a hack and slash.
Yeah. And is it PvP, so you play like other squads? So you like your squad against someone?
It's only co-op, yeah.
Okay, I see. So, I don't know, is there some sort of a crafting system in Vermintide or something like that?
Yeah.
So you can like get items and upgrade those items? So to give you an example of something that Moonstream does is we have crafting systems that exist purely on-chain. So if you're a game designer, you can say, I want my game economy to consist of these types of items, right? Like healing potions and armor and weapons and explosives and this kind of stuff. And I want players to be able to combine these items to create like more complex items or to create upgraded versions of those items and so on. Normally, you would implement those in your game as they do in Vermintide, right? Where like the Vermintide game client or their game server like registers like how many items you have, what you're able to upgrade, like what the recipes look like. Yeah. When you're running a blockchain game, as a general principle, it's good to represent as much of your in-game economy on the blockchain as possible, because that increases the amount of productive things that players in your game can do on chain, and it just increases like the economic health of your game, basically, just by allowing players to have that sort of decentralized control over their items and over crafting and creation and so on. Moonstream implements all of those mechanics. So, for example, Moonstream has an on-chain crafting system that anybody can use to say, like, you know, these are the core components, and these are how they upgrade into, like, you know, this item and this item and this item, and this is how they further upgrade into more and more items. So, like, game designers can just use Moonstream to create on-chain crafting for their players, which, or they can use Moonstream to create, like, loot boxes for their players, where, like, you know, as a reward for beating a boss, you win a loot box, and the loot box contains, like, some random prize. Except instead of just living inside a game server, with Moonstream, that loot box lives on the blockchain, and even the randomness is fulfilled on the blockchain. So when people open up a loot box, the token that they get or the item that they get is sort of randomly determined in a very decentralized way. So those are the kinds of mechanics that we build on chain. We also have mini games that we deploy on chain. So if you want to have, like, some sort of an experience for your players that lives completely on the blockchain, we have, like, a choose your own adventure mini game. We have we're building a combat mini game as well, so you can resolve combat in turns on the blockchain and so on. So that's the kind of stuff that we
build. Okay. And a question for the listeners: how does that benefit the game?
So the principle over here is that, you know, you want to create as much, the loot project example is really the one to follow, where what they did was they released the seed of an idea, or they released, like, the beginning of an idea, and they let the community sort of collaborate together to define, you know, how that idea would evolve. Representing items and representing crafting mechanics and representing loot boxes and representing all of these things on the blockchain opens it up so that now, you know, you as the game developer, maybe you can seed your game universe with, like, a few basic recipes. But for example, like, if a player earns the right by doing well in your game to become, like, a master craftsman themselves, or if they win, like, some sort of a tournament, and then you want them to be able to define, like, a special item that they would like, they have the rights to distribute or something like that. Representing those mechanics on chain makes all of those things possible in a way in which it wouldn't be possible with more traditional games, right? So if you play a game like Vermintide, it would be very difficult for Vermintide to allow you, Steven, to create, like, a kind of item that other players could use when they play Vermintide, and for you to get royalties from that. That's, like, a whole set of infrastructure that, like, traditional game designers or traditional game developers don't even think of. Mm-hmm. But on the blockchain, that's there from the beginning. And so if you hook into all of that infrastructure, and if you hook into those protocols, then Steven, if you like Vermintide a lot, you could actually become, like, someone who's adding to Vermintide, who's, like, you know, creating more unique experiences for other Vermintide players, and you could be rewarded for it. Like, you could actually see, like, tangible, you know, monetary reward for what value you're bringing to other Vermintide players. And that's, I think, that's the magic of blockchain gaming for me, is that, you know, if you as a game player can, like, create value for fellow players and you can see the upsides of that, then now you truly have a community that lasts, like, you know, for more than a few years or more than a couple of decades. You have something that's, like, properly, you know, that's much more permanent. It would also become a much larger part of your identity, right, as a creator. Like, if you really like Vermintide, this allows you to become a contributor to Vermintide without needing anyone's permission to do so, which is really, I think, a very powerful idea.
Yeah, and there are like a lot of games nowadays that are driven by communities and especially the modding communities, and so this basically just rewards the modders for their work and makes them part of the development team, basically.
Exactly.
Among other things, of course, but I can see that the economy just explodes instead of being this tightly regulated thing that is just run from corporate head office. And
exactly.
and it's really easy to do. I mean,
that's
what Moonstream does, right?
Yeah. It's very intuitive. Yeah, we want to make it easy for people to create this kind of content, like for users to be able to create content, for games to accept content from their users and to reward their users for creating that content. Yes, exactly. Actually, I think it's exactly the modding community, you know, like modding community. Some games realize how powerful mods were, right? Like Doom had, like, a fantastic modding community. Doom and Quake had fantastic modding communities. And they might have been some of the earliest games to sort of realize the power of mods. I know Civilization, I used to play a lot of Civilization back in the day, Civ 2. And there was a pretty powerful modding community for Civilization 2. But I think it really took off with Warcraft 3. That's the one that like always sticks out in my mind because that's where Defense of the Ancients came from. And that gave rise to League of Legends, which is like just a powerhouse today, like in terms of, you know, engagement and economy and so on. Or Team Fortress. Team Fortress also came out of, from Half-Life mods, right? So like, but it, I don't know if the people that built the original mods for Dota or the original mods for Team Fortress, if they were the ones who ultimately like saw the upside of like the game experiences that they built. In Web3, those the people who build those things, they can see direct benefit or they can be directly rewarded by communities for building those experiences. Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
So let's get into the nitty-gritty a little bit more. You or Moonstream works with a couple of blockchains, right?
Yeah. We work with Ethereum, we work with Polygon, we work with Gnosis Chain, and we're adding support for more and more blockchains all the time. So our basic principle is that we work with any Ethereum-based blockchain. So right now, the you know, with Ethereum, there's like this movement happening in the ecosystem that there are like these L2 blockchains forming on top of Ethereum, which fundamentally use the same technology as Ethereum, but in different ways, they allow for a much higher rate of transactions than Ethereum does. Because as I mentioned to you before, you know, the Ethereum blockchain processes 200 transactions every 15 seconds or so. That's not like a very high rate of throughput on the transactions. That's the price that you pay for decentralization, for basically, right? So but there are other blockchains where they make like certain trade-offs on decentralization in order to increase the throughput of their blockchains. And so if you're willing to accept like a temporary reduction in decentralization, you can transfer your assets over to that blockchain, you know, resolve transactions faster over there. And then ultimately you can bring stuff over to Ethereum again if you want, or you can at least like have a proof that, of ownership on Ethereum if you want. So that's sort of the basic idea with the L2s. So we're adding support for, we support Ethereum and several L2s, and we're adding support for more L2s over time.
All right. Yeah, I wanted to ask, is there any game that Moonstream is currently working for or with that our audience might know?
Actually, the most popular game that uses Moonstream right now is a game called Crypto Unicorns. It's like sort of a Pokemon-like game. Crossed with a farming sim on it's on the Polygon blockchain. That's the largest project that's using Moonstream right now. And we all also play that game. We are also participating in a few other games, like newer games. Recently, we started playing a game called Conquest.eth, which is like space diplomacy. That's one that's very exciting. There's another one called Darkforest.eth, in which we're going to ramp up our participation over the next couple of months. That's actually a very cool one because they're doing this stuff. You know, one of the biggest problems for games that operate on blockchains is that essentially what happens on blockchain is, you know, when you take an action on the blockchain, it's transparent to everyone. So basically anybody that has access to a blockchain node, if they had enough technical savvy, they could actually like, you know, monitor your transactions and see that you took that action. So, you know, it's very difficult to implement a game that's not a perfect information game on the blockchain, right? So like perfect information, just for anyone who's not familiar with the term, is it refers to games like chess or Go, where the moves that your opponent makes, as soon as they make those moves, they're visible to you as well, right? Like as soon as your opponent does something, you know about it, as opposed to games like StarCraft or, you know, poker, where you actually don't know what moves your opponent can even make or is making, because in the case of poker, their cards are hidden from you. And in the case of StarCraft, there's a fog of war. And if you can scout, and you know, those, I play StarCraft a lot. Sorry, I just assumed that everyone else is familiar with StarCraft. But so with the blockchain, it's really hard to do stuff that's not, you know, public knowledge to everyone else. But Darkforest.eth is using a technology called zero knowledge proofs, where a player can publish a proof of an action that they intend to take. And it's not possible, you know, just from the proof alone to understand what move the player wanted to make. But then later on, when the player actually makes a move, you can verify with the proof that they published initially that that is actually the move that they intended to make from the very beginning. And that kind of technology is very exciting to me as well. And so we definitely plan to participate over there. And then another game that I'm quite excited by is a game called Ethermore on the Ethereum blockchain. That's one that I've sort of been monitoring. It's one that's building slowly. And when the market was like, you know, when the market was booming, it was seen sort of as a negative trait for people to build slowly. But I actually think it's a very positive trait for people to build slowly, because it means that they're in it for the long haul and they're going to keep building for a long time. And so, yeah, I'm quite excited about Ethermore as well. There are several interesting projects, though, on the blockchains. And I think it's really more important for anybody listening, if they're interested in blockchain games, to like go out and find a game that suits like their aesthetic tastes or like, you know, their tastes in gaming, and sort of get involved in those communities and like, you know, sort of dip their toes in the water and see if they like it, because ultimately, you know, it's very hard. It's all subjective. It's everyone's subjective opinion, what they will like or what they won't like. So, yeah.
Yeah. And it might even net you some cash, because you're adding value to something that will in turn give you value back.
Yeah.
Instead of just take the mod and run.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, it's funny how there's a couple of technology or inventions that come back, and the two that are coming back most now are, of course, the non-fungible tokens and or NFTs and the zero knowledge proofs. But it's interesting to see that it has such a wide range of applications. So there's not much left to ask. I wanted to ask, what is next for Moonstream and what is next for you?
Next for me is, you know, probably Moonstream for a long, long time, because I'm really finally, you know, doing something that I really enjoy doing. And with people that I really enjoy doing it with. So I hope this continues for a long time. With Moonstream, you know, as I said, we've started to now play the games as well. And we have some quite interesting things coming up. We write about them. Like, we write about what we're doing inside the games after we've done it. So if anybody's interested in following along, like, you know, we're basically creating the lore of, you know, contributing to the lore of the games that we participate in. So, like, that's something that's very interesting to us. We're going to ramp up our operations in terms of participating in blockchain games. That's something that we think is very important. And we think that the nature of blockchain games is going to change pretty substantially now that the market has crashed. Until now, most blockchain games have not been very entertaining. And the reason that they haven't been entertaining is because there's been so much pressure on them to basically be profitable. And people have been playing these games as a way of like earning income. And when you play a game to earn money, I think it stops being entertaining as a game. It's very hard to like, you know, reconcile both of those things in a single game. But now that, you know, the value of many cryptocurrencies is crashing, blockchain games are no longer a great way to earn money in the short term. For sure, they will not be a great way to earn money. And I think the emphasis is going to shift more into entertainment, but we still believe in the long-term value of these games, right? Because what we're seeing with blockchain games that are sort of successful at capturing people's imaginations is that they're creating communities that are going to stick together, you know, for the long, long, long haul. And the value that they create, even though in the short term is going to be like relatively small, or it's going to be like just even difficult to measure, we think that the long-term value that these games create is going to be immense. And that's really what we're betting on at Moonstream. And we want to participate as creators, as part of those communities. And so that's what we're ramping up in our efforts. Yeah.
So you mentioned that you guys participate in games and that you write about it. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Where can people find that info?
Usually our Twitter account. So our Twitter account is at MoonstreamTO. So our website is moonstream.to and Twitter is MoonstreamTO. So you can follow us on Twitter, and like, you know, we usually publish at least one update per week about like, you know, what we've been up to and like, you know, what we've done in different games. And then also on our Discord. So if somebody wants to play with us, or if somebody wants to like, you know, like talk to us or collaborate with us, we have a Discord channel. So if you go to our website, which is moonstream.to, like to the moon, you can just, there's a link, invite link to our Discord, and you can just join and talk to us. There'll always be someone there to respond to you. So, yeah.
All right, perfect. And then one last question. If people are interested in contacting or connecting with you, what would be the best way for them to reach you?
The best way is probably Discord. That's where I spend most of my day, is the Moonstream Discord. But if you want my handle on every online, like, you know, social platform, except LinkedIn, I don't use LinkedIn that much these days, is Zomglings, Zomglings. So you can just, you know, send me a DM anywhere, and I'll usually be pretty happy to respond. Just mention that you that you came from Steven's podcast, basically.
Perfect. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah. I will try and put the handle in our description so people can find you easily.
Oh yeah, I'll send you the link. Yeah, yeah.
So thank you so much for talking to us, to me. I think our audience really learned a lot, and I know I have. Thank you so much for your time, and let's hope that in a couple of years I can interview you again, and we can hear about all the crazy endeavors and games that, that you guys have been helping.
I hope so too. And thank you, Stephen. I enjoyed speaking with you for sure.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Blockchain Practitioners podcast. And I hope you learned something new today. If you are involved in an interesting blockchain project, feel free to reach out to us. Also, please like, rate, and review this podcast if possible, and share our content with everybody you think would like it. If you'd like some more information about us, you can visit us on LinkedIn or our website at blockchainpractitioners.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you at the next episode.